You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 11th of July 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show,
the interests of our country are best served by the immediate appointment of a strong and well-supported Prime Minister. I am therefore withdrawing from the leadership election, and I wish Theresa May the very greatest success.
Andrea Leadsom quits the UK Conservative Party's leadership race to become a pub quiz answer. Theresa May will move into 10 Downing Street on Wednesday. My guests Samira Shackle and Tim Marshall will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including an attempt to hold Bashar al-Assad legally accountable for the death of a journalist covering Syria's war, and...
Why is he being arrested?
Why is he being arrested right now?
Why is he being arrested?
The damage done to America's reputation by the excesses of its police. And the EU's ideas for punishing Spain and Portugal for failing to meet targets without actually punishing them. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the show. My guests today are Samira Shackle, freelance journalist writing for The New Statesman, Guardian, Al Jazeera, Deutsche Welle, and others, and Tim Marshall, editor of the whatandthewhy.com and foreign affairs analyst. Welcome both. Now, a little less than 3 weeks ago, it seems a lot longer than that, David Cameron was a year into his second term as Prime Minister, having won his party its first majority in a quarter of a century. He would have been looking forward to maybe another 3 years in office, give or take, before stepping down on his own terms as a successful and undefeated statesman. Instead, he's sending for the removalists. 48 hours from now, 10 Downing Street will be home to Theresa May, the last contender standing in the Conservative leadership race following today's withdrawal by someone called Andrea Leadsom. Here is the new Prime Minister.
My case has been based on the need for strong, proven leadership, the need, of course, to negotiate the best deal for Britain in leaving the EU, and to forge a new role for ourselves in the world. Brexit means Brexit, and we're going to make a success of it.
Samira, first of all, Theresa May probably on balance about the most plausible of the contenders for the job, but as she is clearly trying to compensate for there, she campaigned for Remain, if not terribly vocally.
Yeah, absolutely, and she deliberately kept a very low profile during the campaign for the referendum, I think, with this prize in mind. I think she...
The equivalent of John Major's toothache in 1990.
Yeah. Exactly. So I think she was doing sort of much more quiet local level campaigning rather than pinning her flag to the mast in too public a manner. I think that she's, as you say, she hasn't played that up in her subsequent campaign, very short campaign for the Tory leadership. She's positioned herself as the sensible candidate, the grown-up candidate, while sort of Boris Johnson and Michael Gove were involved in a sort of Shakespearean tussle, albeit again very brief. Things are moving at a remarkably fast pace, and against the sort of slightly more reactionary how do I put this sensitively? The sort of slightly outlandish, reactionary, appealing to the UKIP voters, quite bonkers policies that are not policies, just statements that Andrea Leadsom was coming out with. I think she has quite effectively and consistently positioned herself as someone who'll be a tough negotiator, and it's just going to sort of, this is the situation we're in, we're going to move ahead now. And I don't think she wants it to be relevant how she voted in, or sort of how she campaigned in the referendum campaign.
Tim, it is a rare triumph in recent weeks for the familiar, in that we know very well who Theresa May is. I think I'm right in saying she's the second longest serving Home Secretary in UK history. I think she's fallen 3 weeks short of the record, yeah. Which is...
She doesn't mind.
I suspect on balance she's probably not that bothered. But it was a choice between her and, of course, Andrea Leadsom, who, frankly, I'd never heard of a month ago, and I suspect I'm far from alone in that.
You are in this studio because, you know, we follow UK, don't we?
making me feel bad.
The King is dead, long live the Queen. The Conservative Party, you can hear the sound of the doors clanging shut as they all get round the same person. They're very, very good at this.
Offering a certain lesson in parliamentary discipline to another party, yes, not so far away.
To the Labour Party, which is absolutely all over the place. And this country needs an effective opposition, and it hasn't got one, and I don't see that it's going to get one, that it needs line by line going through the policies that Theresa May will start to enact. Look, I don't want to get bogged down in internal UK politics. I think it's more important, especially for your international audience. What does it mean for us all, for everybody? And there's two things for me. Well, three things amongst the things. First of all, sorry, Monty Python reference there. First of all, you heard in the clip there, she said Brexit means Brexit. And she's repeated that. What she means is, look, I know that there's 48% of the country thinks I want another referendum. She's signalling over again, no, I'm not going to do it. That we are going to leave the European Union. The manner in which we leave and what the status is afterwards is to be decided, which brings me very briefly to the second two things. One, she's also on record, she will not trigger Article 50 this year. So early next year, so it's there's 2 years, 2.5 years before the UK leaves. Last one, she is going to appoint a Secretary of State for Brexit, and it's extremely important who gets that job, because that person will negotiate on behalf of Britain what the terms are for the future.
Samira, on that subject, the crucial Article 50, which the ticking parcel that David Cameron handed off to whoever his successor was going to be. No one seems awfully keen to actually trigger that, do they?
No, they don't. I mean, it's kind of there's no going back from it, is there? And I think once that's done, it's a process that's in motion and is quite unstoppable, as you say, a sort of ticking parcel that I don't think anyone quite wants to detonate it too quickly before figuring out.
We don't even have enough civil servants to negotiate this. We need an extra 200.
Yeah,
we could get some in from overseas, perhaps. Yeah.
From Brussels.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's just the apart from anything else, the bureaucratic task ahead is absolutely dizzying. Just, we've got decades and decades of EU laws which are on our statute books, and I don't know how you even begin the task of, let alone negotiating what kind of trade settlement we have or how the free movement works, the political headache of that, the sheer logistical headache of figuring out which laws we keep, which we don't, what we need to rewrite, how that works. It's a massive and unenviable task, and so I think it's probably, yeah, you know, it's sort of good that, as Tim said, that she's going to be appointing someone to deal with that. But how that begins is anyone's guess.
Tim, she's not legally obliged to call an election. In fact, it's actually possibly legally difficult for her to call an election, given the fixed term Parliament's Act. Nevertheless, if it can be done, should it be done?
I personally think so, and I think there'll be a groundswell of opinion in the country that there should be a general election. And again, forgive me, but for the benefit of people who are listening who aren't Brits, the Tory party has crowned her. They have anointed her as the leader, and as they are the party in power, consequently, they have anointed her prime minister. So not a single person in this country has cast a vote for a party knowing that the leader will be her. The Prime Minister will be her.
It's not the first time, though.
No, it's not. But this is a crucial time in British history. And I think there will be a large groundswell of opinion that says, if you want a proper mandate to lead, go to the country, possibly in the spring. The Labour Party, as I said, is all over the place. So legally she isn't. We have fixed-term parliaments brought in previously. So that's 5 years. So legally, she can have another 4 years. It's pretty easy if you get a two-thirds majority. If you want to have an election, you go to the Parliament, you say, look, let's get rid of that act, get your two-thirds majority, get rid of the act, call the election. So it's doable. Let's see if she does it.
Final thought on this from you, Samira, and I guess the same question, but of course there will be a political calculation for her as well in terms of thinking about an early election, not just to provide her with her own mandate, but potentially to capitalise on the shambles still prevailing on the opposition benches.
Yeah, I think that's certainly part of a political calculation. I mean, she has said last week that she isn't going to call an early election. She said that she wouldn't if she became leader. Whether she sticks to that, I don't know. I mean, she could very well argue that she, you know, as someone who is our longest-serving Home Secretary, who is a prominent member of the government that was re-elected, that she does have a mandate. I think she can make that argument in a way that, for instance, Andrea Leadsom would not have been able to, as someone who is a completely unknown quantity. But I think that, I think she said she doesn't want to hold an election. You could make an argument that she should, as you've pointed out. I mean, it's not by far from the first time this would have happened. It's not even the first time in the last decade. And so, I think that I suspect the argument that would be made by Theresa May and her team is that given the upheaval, we just need to get on with it and we don't need the sort of upheaval and expense and chaos and possible further knocks to currency of having a having another election. So I don't know. It's a the only thing certain at the moment is that things are changing very quickly, so who knows?
On the positive side, we have a country of people with their underpants on their heads running around screaming, let's head for the hills. At least someone's in charge now. I mean, it will do something to stabilise politics and the markets and the country.
Indeed so. Well, let's look now at Syria, where by the best guesses of the Committee to Protect Journalists, more than 100 journalists have been killed attempting to cover Syria's civil war, which began in 2011. The vast majority of these, of course, have been Syrian, and their deaths have generally been little heralded. The best-known media casualty of the war remains the American reporter Marie Colvin, the veteran Sunday Times war correspondent who was killed in Homs in 2012. Her family have now filed suit against the government of President Bashar al-Assad. Tim, first of all, their basic pitch is that she was the victim of a campaign deliberately targeting journalists. Now, that's certainly reinforced by journalists I know who spent any time in Syria, that there's little doubt that the regime, certainly at that early stage in the war, regarded foreign journalists as a strategic target. Is there, do you think, any doubt about that? Does their claim have a basis in fact?
No, their claim has a basis in conjecture and even, you could argue, probability. I was friendly with Marie. I knew her. We'd had dinner a couple of weeks before she died. I'd actually done some media training for her when she was doing some broadcast work. And, you know, we all still miss her. But that doesn't mean I want to jump the gun and say she definitely was murdered, because I don't know enough. But I do know that her family believes she was, very, very strongly believes she was murdered. And they have taken legal action through the American courts under the American Sovereign Act. And the basis of it is that the Central Crisis Committee in Syria, run by some thugs, at the time were targeting journalists because they learned too late that they should try and work with them. And they were working against them and blocking them. She got into Homs. She was staying in a place where a lot of journalists were working, and so were some opposition people. Her photographer, Paul, is ex-military, and he understands what's called bracketing. The mortars came in, let's say 100 yards each side, then 70 yards, then 60. They were bracketing, moving in, zeroing in, and then they killed her. That is the basis of it, that it was a deliberate target of a big journalist from a big, important media outlet, the Sunday Times, and therefore they murdered her. But the reason I can't say that's fact is because A, I don't know quite enough about it, and B, that would be for a court to decide.
Samira, if this case does go anywhere, does it make... Well, I mean, for a start, it's very hard to imagine the Assad regime taking it terrifically seriously, but does it make life any tougher for regimes of that ilk who do want to target journalists? Basically, I'm asking, is this going to go anywhere?
I think it's quite difficult to see it landing too much of a blow on the Assad government, as you said. Partly they've got bigger fish to fry, and secondly, they haven't got a great track record on taking international condemnations particularly seriously. So I don't think it will make a huge difference there. I suppose I imagine what the family's motivation would be, as well as a sort of personal drive for justice and sort of pursuing what they believe to be true about the case, and sort of doing right by their deceased relative. I would also imagine that they want to, and I think they've said this in statements, that they want to raise awareness about the risks faced by journalists, particularly in Syria, but also in war zones more generally, and it might do that. I don't know. Given the fact that it's unlikely to land much of a blow really on the Assad government, I doubt it will be a huge disincentive to other governments seeking similar action. But perhaps it will shine a light on the issue of safety for journalists. I would hope that that would be on sort of safety for domestic journalists as well as international. But I don't know. It's sort of, I think that will probably be what the case achieves beyond the personal motivations, if anything.
I mean, Tim, do we have a clear idea of, and I'm not quite sure how to phrase this, but what, I guess, protection or consideration is owed by any combatant entity, whether it's a government or a non-state military force, what they owe to any journalist, especially to any foreign journalist, who decides to turn up in the middle of their conflict?
They are all bound. Any state, and therefore an army belonging to the state, is bound by the Geneva Conventions, which does lay out over several paragraphs how to treat journalists and non-combatants. So it is there as a body of law which you're supposed to abide by. Of course, it falls down very, very quickly if you are perceived to be hostile to the state that you're with. And what happened in Syria was that both sides fairly quickly turned against you. It happened more and more. In Bosnia, we all turned up in what we called soft-skin vehicles, no flak jackets, nothing. We learned very quickly. Followed on from that was the kit that started arriving. Followed on that was the training, the first aid. There's been massive leaps and bounds. There's the Marie Colvin Circle, there's the Rory Peck Trust, there's the Reporters Without Borders, etc., etc. But if you are going to go into the, if you're going to cross the lines and go into a hostile environment where the enemies of the state, which was the Free Syrian Army, if you're going to go with them, there's no amount of training is going to save you if your number's up. But you can mitigate it. You can mitigate it through the equipment you've got, the medical packs you've got, telling people where you are, what's going on. And I agree with one of the points that you made. If just 1% of this court case gets through to some despotic leader somewhere and they think, you know what, remember there was a case taken against Assad, let's not go after the journalists. Well, even that's a tiny, tiny silver lining.
I mean, Samira, and I'll ask you about this as well, Tim, if we've got time. But does it seem to you, Samira, that the rules, and I don't mean the legal rules, but I mean the rules as in terms of the conventions, as the way conflict is now waged, have been altered to the disfavour of journalists? They are now regarded more and more as legitimate targets.
It does seem that way, yeah. I mean, I think that obviously nobody can guarantee their safety in a war zone, not journalists, not civilians, not soldiers, not anyone. But it does seem that way that, I mean, we've seen in the last few years the sort of very high profile and brutal murders of journalists in Syria by non-state actors, by ISIS and so on, and affiliated groups of local Middle Eastern journalists as well. And so it does seem that way. And it's not just journalists either. I mean, there's lots and lots of reports proliferating about hospitals being targeted and medical staff in all different parts of the world who are also a group who should be protected, I think, and under the Geneva Conventions. And so we're seeing all these sorts of rules and givens, I think, being broken down and chipped away at, and it's a very disturbing trend.
Is that your view, Tim? I mean, I defer to your vastly greater experience. I saw very small amounts of Bosnia and very small amounts of Iraq. Iraq was noticeably more dangerous than Bosnia. It strikes me that Syria right now is several
top of the
leagues
train. Top of the train.
On.
Yeah, look, Marie's death, and even more, my friend Mickey Dean, who was shot in Cairo by, we are almost certain, an Egyptian soldier, sniper. That's one of the reasons why I just packed it in. I thought I've had enough of this. The journalists have become targets in war zones, and they really genuinely didn't used to be. It started a little bit in Bosnia, and each conflict that's gone on, and it just shows you how divided everybody is. And also, I think one thing that plays into it is both 24-hour media, but critically the internet. People can now see your reports. And if they take any sort of exception, because if you're not on their side, they think you're against them. And because they can see your reports and you weren't for them, they think that legitimizes you as a target. Briefly as well, it's the same in riots now, right? Media are becoming targets, and it's a sad time, and it needs to be turned around somehow.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, Tim Marshall, and Samira Shackle. This is Monocle 24.
In Times of Change, our second film report from the Venice Architecture Biennale focuses on how the National Pavilions responded to curator Alejandra Aravena's quest for new points of view on the social, political and cultural issues facing the world of architecture today.
We felt as architects, as exhibition makers, but also as members of civil society, and we wanted to become active. So action speaks louder than words. We think nobody can say that we cannot do better. We can. The only question is, do we want to do it better?
You can watch our Venice Architecture Biennale coverage by heading to the film section at monocle.com.
You're welcome back to Midori House. Still with me are Samira Shuckle and Tim Marshall. Now, almost any major domestic event in the United States becomes an international story. And recent stories pertaining to police brutality against black people and other ethnic minorities have gone predictably global, to the extent that the Bahamas has advised its citizens, in particular young males, to exercise extreme caution in any dealings with the cops. And the United Arab Emirates has suggested that its citizens disdain traditional Arab garb when in America for fear of being mistaken for terrorists. Samira, are these overreactions by the Bahamas and the UAE?
I don't think so. Not really. I mean, you've got widespread unrest and tension largely between ethnic minority communities and the police. Pretty horrible statistics. I think in 2015, the 100 unarmed black people were killed by police. Only 10 of those resulted in any charges being brought against an officer. Only 2 of those resulted in a conviction. So, I mean, it's a highly, highly tense atmosphere. And I think that you could argue sometimes when a sort of less developed country issues travel warnings about a more developed, theoretically more stable country, that there's an element of tit for tat. I think in this case that advice is probably quite sensible and probably a lot less alarmist than a lot of the travel advice that America issues to its citizens sort of on a weekly, sometimes more than weekly basis.
I mean, Tim, not to at all minimise these recent stories, the most recent ones especially, which have been dreadful, but do we focus, I guess, as a news media, disproportionately on America because it's America? If these stories had happened in China or France, and I'm sure stories like this do happen in China or France.
They certainly happen in Brazil.
Or indeed Brazil. Would they be as big a story?
No, they wouldn't. But we don't go to China. The world doesn't go to China. I mean, the world goes to America. The place most migrants want to move to work is the United States. It's the second most visited country in tourism. The world is fascinated and sometimes horrified by America. I agree with Samir that I don't think it is in any way overstating it for the Bahamas, which mostly is black people in the Bahamas, to say to people going to the States, look, if you come across a cop, just make sure you're completely calm, because look at the stats. More white men are shot by the police in America each year, but there's a lot more white men. And
indeed,
if you look at it statistically, I think it's something like you're 3 times more likely to be shot if you're black by the cops, which is, the evidence is there. Now, the reasons behind it are extremely complicated, but the evidence is there. So I don't think it's an overreaction at all. And I'd say about anybody, going to the States. I remember I didn't run a red light. I went over a stop sign in New York City once, just a few feet, just the wheels. And I was pulled out of a car and shouted at by a NYPD blue just for going a couple of feet. It's zero tolerance kind of place.
No, it is. My only experience with the United States police was in Washington State, where the photographer I was traveling with, we stopped on a highway because he wanted to take a picture of an amusing road sign, and a cop car pulled up and they drew guns on us. And you're having to find, we were really 2 of the whitest people who've ever set foot on the American continent. And we still found ourselves having to go, fellas, really settle down. Samira, do we hold America, I guess, and this is trying to turn this into a backhanded compliment of the US, I guess, do we hold it to a different standard? Do we expect America should be better than this?
That's an interesting question. I think there's a sort of countercurrent, certainly in Britain, of feeling quite superior to America. We're a bit cleverer, we're more intellectual, we don't have guns everywhere, blah, blah, blah. But
government is a model of stability.
Exactly. I saw quite a funny headline on that topic, actually. It was a comedy piece a few weeks ago saying Britain loses right to claim that Americans are dumber. I think that perhaps there is an element. America has sort of set itself up, is the world's sort of greatest superpower, and it set itself up as the guardian of and projector of certain values, sort of democracy and justice and rights for all and all of these things. So I think that perhaps given that it's given itself its role and sort of been anointed in that by other countries as well, but certainly sets itself up to that. That's the image it projects, that's the image it has of itself. I think there is probably an element of when there are these sort of wild injustices and rights clearly aren't equal for all, there probably is an element of that not just being about those contradictions, but also being seen as a kind of hypocrisy.
Okay, well, finally tonight, when Portugal recovers from its triumph in last night's European Championship final, it, along with its neighbour Spain, is due a wigging from the European Commission for failure to meet targets on budget deficit limits. Both countries are now technically liable for penalties, not the shootout variety, although EU sources suggest that the fines may be assessed at a less than outrageously punitive zero. Tim, is the EU, for obvious enough reasons, suddenly getting all worried about inflaming anti-establishment sentiment?
You've hit the nail on the head as always, Andrew. If this was before the Brexit vote, the Eurozone committee might be minded to slap both Spain and Portugal and say, come on, guys, you're Spain, for example, minus 5.1% budget deficit. You're way outside what you agreed to when you joined the Eurozone. We're going to have to fine you. Post the budget, the Brexit vote, I'm more thinking that they're minded, you know what, we need to keep this family together, we don't want to upset anybody, and so they may not do very much at all. The guy running it is a Dutchman, and he might put some steel into them. They've already told the Italians the state's not going to bail out the Italian banks. The Italian banks are going to bail out themselves. We'll see how that goes. But, you know, the story, as you've rightly identified, has to be seen in the context of Britain leaving and what's going to happen to the rest of the union. And there is this battle royale now that is breaking out. Do we seek ever closer union and we're all good buddies and friends, or actually do we drift slightly apart in order to stay together? And this story is part of that.
I mean, Samira, I may be reading far too much into this, but is there a possible signal here to the United Kingdom that, you know, maybe we can be a bit flexible? We in the European Union, maybe the rules can be bent, like, you know, freedom of movement, and which was what your referendum thing was basically about, etc.
I'm not sure, though, because I think, you know, all the things Tim was talking about not wanting to empower the anti-establishment and anti-EU voices and elsewhere in the EU, I think that there's a real and probably quite justified fear that giving too favourable a deal to us, where we're essentially allowed to get rid of the bad bits or the bits we don't like and keep the good bits, will just really encourage a lot of other people to start clamouring to do the same, and then the whole thing falls apart, really. So I don't know if I would take too much optimism for our pretty terrible situation there.
But there will be people on the UK side. Yeah. The cat's out of the bag. The Dutch are thinking, are we going to have a referendum? 48% of the French want out. Nearly 50% of the Italians want out. I mean, the game is on. And it's simply about what will the shape of it look like in 2 to 5 years' time.
But on that note, though, doesn't it accelerate that process or make a crack-up more likely if the EU won't actually impose the rules or impose punishments when those rules are broken?
This is where the argument goes round and round and round and nobody knows the answer, because you're right, it might do. But if you try to make sure you have ever closer union and deepen it and strengthen it, you risk cracking it. Now, that's the French and possibly the Germans' initial reaction, let's go for more Europe. That risks cracking it for those that don't want it. If you, conversely, start arguing, no, we need to be looser, that risks drifting completely apart. I mean, we don't know where we're going. We just know that we're going there.
And finally tonight, we should talk extremely briefly, like in about 10 seconds each, about any potential sort of further ongoing upsides to Portugal's triumph in a thoroughly dull game last night. I mean, Samira, once they've slept it off, is this good for Portugal beyond the fact that they've all had a pleasant night out last night?
Yeah, I don't know, really. It's a bit of a bummer to wake up with a hangover from the celebration and a potential sanctions from the mothership, isn't it?
Tim, is this
a boost? It's good. It's fine. I don't think it has any economic effect. I don't believe all that rubbish. The Olympics don't have an effect on economies. I just think it's great for the Portuguese. They can have a great time. I love football. It was a boring tournament. I look forward to the next one.
And that's all we have time for on today's Midori House. It was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Barclay Brahma. Studio manager was Toby Hammond. Thanks also to my guests Samira Shackle and Tim Marshall. More music next at 1900 London time. It's Culture with Rob Bound. There's more on the day's main stories on the daily at 2200. I'll also be your host for that. Midori House returns at 1800 London time tomorrow. But for now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.